Today is a sad day, and it's a happy day, too. And it's also November 7th, 2018. This is episode number 487 of The Context Machine. And I know that because Jim Tanis told me. This is a podcast for The Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief of The Mac Observer.
And I'm Jim Tanis, assistant to the regional manager. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note over at facebook.com/groups/context machine.
Indeed. I like you, grok the title thing. Thank you.
I'm trying my best. Yeah, I stayed up all night just obsessing over it.
Well, yeah, that much is obvious. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get that. We get that. All right. Well, Jim is joining me here as my first guest for the revamped Apple Context Machine. With a big salute to Jeff. And did you listen to last week's show?
I did not, unfortunately. I've just been.
Oh, man, we did the whole thing. We had the skits. We had the interns.
Oh.
We had Ricky Spiro came and made an appearance, and he might have locked me and Jeff up in a dungeon somewhere, and because of the way we treated the interns.
A special event, not just day to day normalcy.
must be Wednesday.
Well, I'm still in shock. To be fair, in my defense, you know, hearing about Jeff's departure, I'm still not. I haven't processed that quite yet.
Fair enough. And I am making all kinds of mic noise that I may or may not edit out. All right, let's see here. Yeah, I am too. But Jeff is off at Smile, doing his new thing there, and we wish him the best of luck.
Oh, absolutely! And what a great developer to go to.
Indeed,
Smile,
yeah.
Smile has some of the. They've been around for forever, and they've always been one of the top tier Apple developers. And now they've got products available for Windows too, so it's great.
Yeah, Windows.
Well, inclusion, right? Yeah.
Whatever.
Diversity.
Windows. All right. Speaking of diversity, you have a bee in your bonnet about Apple's T2 chip. You're going to have to look, dude. You're just going to have to roll with me on my segues. Okay. if you're going to occasionally guest on this show, you've got to be prepared for the segues.
I'm going to try here. Okay. So, yes, and it is buzzing. Well, so what we found out, the T2 chip is Apple's custom silicon that's in their recent Macs. It's the iMac Pro from last year, the 2018 MacBook Pros, and the new Mac Mini.
And before that, it was the T1 chip.
Oh, yes. And we've learned as they've added stuff to this. It's sort of like a magic little box. At first, we thought it was, well, we first heard about Apple's T series chips. People suspected it would be a way to do iOS emulation, and maybe that will become one of its features in the future. But we now know it does security. It does the storage controller. So it's one of the things that helps you get those insane multi-gigabyte per second speeds out of your flash memory. And now we also know it does video encoding. Video encoding is when you're taking your video and converting it into a playable format. It can be when you finalize your movie in iMovie and export it to your Apple TV, or it could be when you rip a DVD in Handbrake and put it into an iTunes-compatible format. And traditionally, that was very CPU-intensive. And processors got faster, and encoders got more efficient, and it got to a point where it was reasonable. But then a couple years ago, GPU-accelerated encoding became a big thing. And that's leveraging the power of your AMD or NVIDIA chip or the internal graphics in your Intel processors to massively increase the speed. But the problem was you lose quality. It's much faster, but the quality is noticeably worse than CPU-based encoding. That got better over the years, and to the point where the latest chipsets from Intel and NVIDIA do a pretty good job. But now there's another option. It's this T2 chip in the Macs that have it can do video encoding with applications that support it. And right now that's Final Cut Pro and, well, technically Compressor, which is the encoding component of the Final Cut suite. iMovie, I think, if it doesn't support it already, it will shortly. And of course, FFmpeg too, which is the base media encoder that a lot of applications like Handbrake and stuff use. But you can also use FFmpeg as a command line tool. You can install it via Homebrew and queue up your scripts to encode your videos. And the latest builds of Handbrake, or the latest builds of FFmpeg support the T2 chip for video encoding. So I've been playing with that, and it is significantly faster. It does not tax your processor. It does not tax your graphics card. So you're cutting down on heat.
Wait, hold on. You say you've been playing with it. Is that the wording you used?
Yes.
Can you like actually specify what you mean there?
Sure. So I've been encoding videos with FFmpeg, instructing it to use the T2 chip instead of the CPU or the GPU in the MacBook. And this is my test machine is a 2018 15-inch MacBook Pro. This would also work on the iMac Pro or the Mac Mini. And okay. I'm encoding Blu-ray rips in my case. So I think the exact movie was the Jurassic World movie from a couple years ago. I've got that on Blu-ray. I ripped it using MakeMKV, and I got a file, and I've been doing some tests on comparing it to CPU encoding, GPU encoding, and T2 encoding. And the T2 is the fastest out of all three by a good margin.
Can you combine those?
No, at least not under any current software that's being used. You could do parallel encode. So if you had like three movies, you could queue up separate FFmpeg instances and encode them all at the same time. But you couldn't, as of right now, leverage multiple components for the same file.
Because that seems like that would be a cool thing to do.
Yes. And I mean, to a certain degree, you are using the CPU. The CPU is active, but you're not.
Well, yeah,
you're not
it's directing. It's directing the software to do its thing with the T2 chip.
Yes, and so there is some combination of energies there, but it's not a discrete sort of really putting all the effort at one thing. At least not yet. I don't know what the technical challenges would be of implementing that, but all I know is with FFmpeg in its current form and with things like Final Cut Pro and Compressor, they're not combining everything all together.
Right.
But it's dramatic. So in my case, with Jurassic World, it's a Blu-ray 1080p. The CPU encoding was encoding at about 40 frames per second. And that's at medium quality settings with H.264. The Intel GPU, so using basically Intel QuickSync, which is what they call their GPU-based encoding for their integrated graphics processor, was getting about 70, and the T2 chip was about 110 to 120 wow. frames per second.
So the T2 chip, which has other jobs, mm-hmm. is faster than GPU encoding.
At least with that GPU. Now, if I were to compare that to a PC workstation running the latest NVIDIA graphics cards,
right.
maybe not. But
right.
in that particular instance, it's very fast. And you're not, if in the MacBook context, in a portable context, you're not draining your battery or heating it up and causing the fans to kick in. It's very efficient. It's very fast.
And almost three times faster, at least in this one instance, than the CPU.
Yeah. Now, where this really gets powerful, because that's pretty good, is when you move to HEVC encoding. HEVC is the next codec. It's also known as H.265 or X.265 in its open source implementation. It's the whole thing about HEVC is that it provides better quality at the same bit rate, generally. And it's not as old, and it's not as efficient, and it's not as tweaked as H.264, but it's still pretty good. In fact, if you've bought a UHD Blu-ray, 4K Blu-ray, those are encoded in HEVC. So it's good enough for the commercial market as of right now. But the thing is, it's so much more demanding of processors. So on my MacBook, using good quality settings, like you can speed it up by lowering the quality, but to use an acceptable quality level, my MacBook was encoding it at about 7 frames per second. The Intel GPU was encoding at about 15, and the T2 was hitting about 30 to 35.
Wow, man, that is significant.
Yeah, huge improvement. Now, you do see the quality difference. I think it's an acceptable quality at that speed, but if you were to put that next to the 7 frames per second CPU-based encode, you would see a slight difference. My view is most people won't care with the CPU being better. CPU encoding generally is a better quality bit for bit than hardware accelerated encoding.
I don't want to lose anything.
Sure. So then you have to make the trade-off of, do I wait? Do I take all that time to encode it at 7 frames per second? Or do I say, well, I probably wouldn't notice, especially if it's not side by side. If I'm just watching this down the road on my Apple TV, I may not even care. And I can encode it 5 times faster.
Can you not choose to do better quality with the T2 that's slower than the faster? Work with
you mean, so can you increase the quality further so it's still faster, but
yes,
better quality? No. I mean, yes, you could, but there's a maximum setting on what the current options are for refining quality on the part, on the chip, with FFmpeg at least, in its current form. And you hit that, and you're still going to be 25 to 30 frames per second, and you're still going to notice the difference. Bit for bit, software encode via CPU is going to look better than a hardware encode. Technically, again, you may not care. The vast majority of people may not even notice if they don't see it side by side, but the differences are there. So what you come down to is speed. What am I willing to sacrifice? If I've got 100 movies to get through to add them to my media server, am I going to do I want the better quality and wait longer?
Yes, better quality.
Sure.
Better quality.
That's the choice.
Always better quality.
Well, in that case, you should probably be ripping them without transcoding. Get the raw file that's 40 gigabytes.
Okay, now we're talking.
And then go and pick up. Now, the Apple TV won't be able to play that natively, but you can go pick up an app like FireCore. FireCore is the company. I think the app is Infuse. And the Infuse app, which is for Apple TV and iPhone, will play anything natively. So in that case, you're fine. Or you could use Plex, although Plex on the Apple TV is getting a little quirky these days. So I don't know if that's the best option. But
do you know what else is quirky? This is an actual segue. Have you used DirecTV Now?
Yes, I tried it out when it first launched for a few months.
Their Apple TV app is crap.
Oh, okay. I thought it was okay when I first tried it. Again, it's been several months.
DVR controls don't work very well.
Oh, okay. See, I tried it before they introduced the DVR.
And part of that, I think, is the terrible Apple TV remote.
Yeah, it's a problem. Although you can program, like I've got my universal remote, that my Harmony, that does the Apple TV for me.
Yeah, I should actually get around to getting a Harmony. The app likes to quit. I really enjoy that. It'll just quit, like you're watching a show and then you're not watching a show because the app has just dumped back to the Apple TV desktop. Individual shows sometimes freeze. All of the navigation controls are quirky. You've got you're watching a show that you have either way. So you're watching a show and you hit the menu button to bring the on-screen controls to go elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. And you hit it again. And then you have to hit the select button to finally return down to back to your video. So you actually have to use two separate buttons to return to your video with multiple presses. It's just inelegant as can be. It's been driving me nuts. And I did cut my cord. I am direct, and this, I don't really think DirecTV Now is all that cord cutting, but not at all pleased with that DirecTV Now app.
Oh, that's a shame to hear. Have you tried other services like the?
I've used. I have not used another box. I don't want to use another box.
Oh no, I mean other subscription services.
Hulu and YouTube. TV.
Okay, YouTube TV, yeah.
Yeah, and they both have their issues, too. The Hulu app is, the navigation is just crap, but everything tends to work. The YouTube TV does a pretty good job with the on-screen TV guide, but is also quirky and not great on Apple TV. And I should add that the DirecTV Now app does do a good job with the TV guide. But the rest of the app is just like crap, and their DVR service is crap.
Oh, that's.
I thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, that's a shame. Like my experience, it was pre DVR. It was like right when the service first launched. Was that it was probably the best of the ones at that point. But yeah, I guess
there's a lot of things. If you don't okay, when I first started using it, I was pretty pleased. The more I used it, the more problems I encountered.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, just so like here's a fun one. So again, this is DVR, which their DVR service is technically in beta. I think that they will record up to 20 hours or 20 gigs. It's like nothing whatsoever that they'll record for you. And, you go to like thumb through a show and like finding the shows is weird. Sometimes it won't remember where you've left off and it'll forget that you have played an episode entirely. That's really cool. I'd really enjoy that part. That's kind of awesome. That's probably maybe one of my favorite things is when I have to actually go and find the point in the show where I am. Now that gets really cool when you're watching a show where DirecTV has agreed to allow the IP holder to keep you from using the fast forward function.
Ah, yes. Of
course. So like, for instance, I was watching The Rookie, which is Nathan Fillion's new show. Mm-hmm. Have you seen it?
I've not seen it. I've heard though. I was eager to.
It's okay.
I've missed him. Castle went off.
Exactly, right? Castle was great. This is not Castle 2, so don't be expecting Castle 2. So I was watching an episode. I'm 40 minutes into it. I missed something. So I'm trying to go back 10 seconds. So I hit the side of the Apple TV remote so that I can go back 10 seconds. Well, it decides to dump me completely out of the show and then forgets that it's recorded it.
Oh, geez.
From one click. Right?
Yep.
So I go looking for the show again, and I can watch it from the on-demand aspect that DirecTV now does offer.
Yeah.
And so I go to start the episode, and I want to get back to my 40-minute mark. Can't do it.
Yeah.
Man. That is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things we've been looking at here is there's another player that came into this whole thing a few months ago, and it was surprising because the company offering it is HD Home Run, the company that makes the, you know, little TV tuners.
Yep.
They have a subscription cable streaming service, and it's like $35 a month. It doesn't have all the channels I would want, but it's got a good selection. And the difference is that you have to buy one of their tuners, and the tuner then is the entry point. You hook it into your network, and it's the entry point for the content. So you tie your account with HD Home Run to the box, and then once it hits that box in your house, it's accessible DRM free to any device that can read the HD Home Run video feeds. So the HD Home Run app itself, Plex with its live TV and DVR service, the Channels app, which is a $20 third-party app on Apple TV, which last time I checked was pretty good. And so now you've got options for which app you want to use. You're getting all those cable channels you want. You're getting the benefit of having them come over the internet. You could record them without restrictions, play them back, and if an app like is crashing on you, you can switch to another one, and it's the same set of channels. There's a little bit of quirks right now in getting it to map properly to TV Guide because it's a different way of doing things. You know, all the magic's happening in that box, and so once it comes out of that box, your devices have to know how to talk to it. But once you get it set up, it's pretty great. And we were using Plex as the basis for our tests here, and you set up your DVR, you set up the live TV, and you get the benefit of over the air as well because you have your antenna hooked up, and then you get all your cable channels coming through the network. So that's something if you're looking for another solution that's not PlayStation, DirecTV, Sling, whatever, that's one to consider for folks who, you know, are not opposed to, if they don't have one, they're not opposed to buying one of those HD Home Run boxes.
That makes sense. Now, where are you writing this up? What are you even doing these days? You used to write for me.
I know. Sorry.
I'm a little bitter about that.
No. So I write at techreview.com. Techreview is TKRV.
You were the editor in chief?
I'm editor in chief, and pretty much it's I've got a couple great contributors, but it's just me primarily.
Sure.
And
you're so a machine and a stud, so you know that works for you.
I guess so. It seems to be so far. And we cover Mac, Windows, gaming, things like that. It's a
wait, hold on, Mac. And what was the second one?
Yeah, it's, I know. Okay, fine.
Was it?
That's
what'd you call it?
It's I called it the number one computing platform by market share.
And yet still strangely sucky. Okay, got it. Oh, Windows.
Yeah, it sucks.
Windows. Okay, right. Anyway, but you cover Windows over there. Fine. Fair enough.
Yes. Windows, Mac, iOS, a little bit of Android, although not as much just because I'm not as familiar with it. I have Android devices. I just don't like them. So,
hey, good news, by the way. As we're, like, right now on my Apple Watch, Jeff Sessions just resigned.
Oh. Resigned or was forced out?
Both.
Okay. Like, what's the public narrative? Resign?
At President Trump's request.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, wonderful. Let's, we don't need to drag
people. No, we really don't. I just kind of wanted to mark this moment in history, you know, like to give this discussion some historical context. Like, you know, people can go, so, like, at what point at the end of the world did was the show recorded? Anyway.
That will only matter if there's anything left to find.
That's a fair point. Okay, so are you actually, you said you're testing all this stuff, so are you writing about this at Tech Review?
Some of it gets written up either at Tech Review or at another site that I contribute to, which is PC Perspective at pcper.com, and that's computer hardware.
Excellent, yes.
So,
PC,
yes.
Now, PCs are those computers that aren't Macs or iPads.
Well, no, a PC is a personal computer, which qualifies as a Windows box, a Linux box, a Mac box, you know, it's... Mm. A PC is, and that's the focus here. It's. I mean, really? Obviously, sure, it's a personal computer because the tech that's in your Mac, most of it, you know, is not that different, and in fact, is often identical to this tech that's in another box. Yeah,
but you know, there's the piece.
Hey, I'm not arguing that there's not a difference in experience. Like, obviously, the software makes a huge difference. But, you know, let's not pretend, you know, your iMac has an Intel processor and
an AMD
GPU.
For now. You know that's coming, right?
That's coming, of course. I was a little, you know, we'll see the timing, but I'm sure that we'll get there.
Yeah, the 2019, 2020 at the latest, as early as 2019. It's coming. Apple is moving the Mac to its own line of AX processors.
Yep. And we will have that at that point. But right now, your Mac is running the same.
It is. Hardware. It is true. But it's you know. But like, so I'm actually going back. Yeah. I mean, you're a youngin.
Not that young.
but I remember this was back when like I think color TV had just been introduced. But IBM introduced the PC. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the PC is technically that x86 DOS Windows thing.
In certain contexts, yes, I'm sure.
Yeah, so, you know. So.
Right, and your Intel processor in your Mac is running x86 instruction set.
Yeah, that's true. It is running the x86 instruction set, but it's not running Windows or DOS.
That's why Hackintoshes are a thing.
But it's not running Windows or DOS.
Well, mine is. I've got Boot Camp.
Well, okay, that is a...
Your argument's kind of falling apart here,
that's an interest. That's such a philosophical concept. Uh-huh. Does a Mac running Windows in Boot Camp, does it become a PC? Now, your argument has been that it's been a PC all along. Your argument is wrong.
Okay.
But at that point, does it become a PC? And I think the answer may be yes.
Well, in the words of noted Apple watcher Walt Mossberg, right? Don't uh-huh. The MacBook Pro is the best PC you can buy.
Huh.
Remember that?
Yeah.
I think early on in the MacBook
Pro. Yeah, I do remember that. Yep.
Yeah, that was the press. The Apple published that during their keynote, saying that, you know, if you're going to buy, if you need a Windows computer, you should buy a Mac and just put Windows on it because the hardware is better than anything else out there.
I think I've only had one interaction with Walt Mossberg, and it's when I called him an Apple fanboy. And then he wrote me. and said, I am not an Apple fanboy.
Well, whatever he's doing, it's worked out for him, so.
Right. Okay, so next topic that sort of went a little further afield than I had anticipated, but I enjoyed talking about Apple TV. You are also going on about Mac Mini RAM.
Yeah. So the original, okay, not the original, but the redesign of the Mac Mini that took place in 2010, I think it was, where it moved to that smaller form factor. Uh-huh.
I'm laughing not at you. I'm laughing at just how much poop Apple has heaped on the Mac Mini over the years.
Oh, well, sure. But so that original Mac Mini redesign in 2010 had a really nice form factor for upgradability. You turned the bottom, popped it off, and right there in front of you was the RAM, and the hard drive was not right in front of you, but it was accessible. It was not terrible to get it out and replace it. And I did that on a number of Macs between 2010 and 2012. And then
you also replaced your processors in your Mac Pro.
My Mac Pro, yes, not my Mac Mini.
Right,
the Mac Mini was much easier to work with.
Yeah, but that brain transplant was nothing to sneeze at. I'm just saying
it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't something I'd recommend to a completely inexperienced user. But if you have steady hands and you're willing to take your time and follow the instructions, it's not overly complicated. It's not like something impossible. It's pretty straightforward. It's just you have to be careful about the order in which you take the parts out and be careful with the parts and stuff. But but the Mac Mini itself, particularly with the RAM, was designed. You know, my mom could have done it if she felt confident. You know, it was not something that was beyond the average user.
Okay.
And then, of course, the Mac Mini went without an update for 3 years, or a couple, 2 years, I guess. Right. Almost three.
So 1,400, 1,500 days?
It was a long time.
I think it was more than 5 years.
Well, let's see. Well, no, that was between. So there was the 2012, and then there was the 2014. And then so in 2014, they updated it, and it was in all ways a downgrade. And I wrote a scathing editorial about it at the time. The processors, they moved from quad-core higher wattage parts to dual-core lower wattage parts, so lower performing, worse graphics, and they had soldered the RAM. You couldn't upgrade the RAM. And in fact, they kept the same chassis. So you'd got the new Mac Mini and you turn it over and there was the little shield that you would normally twist to take off, and you twist it and it comes off and you're just faced with a metal plate. Huh. It's like, well, I guess you had some extra chassis lying
around. That was a little insult mixed in with the injury there,
I guess. I mean, and it was a bad upgrade. It was in my view, an objectively bad thing.
But at least we had it for 4 years, so that's cool.
Right, and then they didn't upgrade it for 4 years, and now finally
they're back. Hold on. But the cool thing was that they charged the same price the entire 4 years.
Yes, and well, then that's par for the course for Apple. They're still charging the same price for the 2013 Mac Pro. Yeah, it's the same same price as it was. Almost all their config. If you go on there now, you can spec out a $13,000 Mac Pro that's using parts that were introduced in 2012.
No. They did a quarter update 3 years ago.
What was that? I don't recall.
So ridiculous. They like lopped off the lower entry point, and. God, did they upgrade the video card?
I don't think so. I think the processor, there's still V2 Intel chips, and there's still
AMD. No, they did something. They did something that was like supposed to be throwing.
They might
us a
have
bone.
Lowered the price of the entry level slightly.
I'm not defending Apple on the Mac Pro or the Mac Mini.
Yeah, and the Apple Store's website is down, so. Like legit down, not like post-it note down. So they didn't update it. They didn't lower the price. But then finally last week, was it last week or the week before? Time's moving too slow.
Last week.
Yeah, their keynote last week, they among other things, released a new Mac Mini. Same form factor, But adding Thunderbolt 3, adding new processor options, and they made a point to note this during the keynote, user upgradable RAM. Mm-hmm. And they showed a picture on the stage of the bottom open and the RAM, and it looked very similar to what we saw in the 2012 models. But now that the review units hit the reviewers, and now that I think it's on sale today, people are getting it and they're seeing, well, yes, it is upgradable, which is good, but it's not as easy as it looked from that keynote. It is not the same as the 2012. When you open it up, you have to remove a cooling fan and then a shield to get to the RAM, and then it's kind of tucked under the lip of the opening. So it's completely doable for someone who's, you know, technical and stuff, but it's not the kind of thing where the average user would feel perfectly comfortable doing it.
You know what? I'm not going to ding Apple for that, though. I mean, as long as it could be changed by a normal human being, that is at the very least, I don't know, maybe like a step cattywampus.
No, it's definitely an improvement, absolutely, and because we went from not having it at all under any circumstance because it was soldered to, yes, it's now socketed SODIMMs. So good, great. But my point is just people expecting that it's the same thing, because that's, they showed a picture of it and it looked like the same layout as the 2012, and it's not.
Did they show a false layout?
I don't know if, because they, I, it may have, it may
I
not
think
be
it's a, just, it's just a situation where it looks similar, but once people started digging into it, they realized that there were a couple more steps that had to be gone through.
I mean, maybe that's the case, but maybe in the picture they just removed everything you'd have to remove.
So
just, I think that's the issue.
Oh,
there, there were components missing from that slice that they showed.
I see. All right.
But again, that's great. And
that's great.
The issue is, and the reason that's great, even though it might be more challenging than we thought, is because Apple still charges an insane amount of money for memory. There is no advantage to Apple memory at all. They cannot void your warranty if you use the same spec memory. It's not faster. It's not more reliable. As long as you're buying from a legit brand.
Hold on. You can get RAM that fits, that is lower quality. Is using the highest spec RAM for that kind of RAM, and Apple always has.
No, they're using quality RAM, and there are specs. There are speed and timing ratings for memory. And as long as you put in the same timing speed spec memory, in this case it's 2666 megahertz, DDR4 SODIMMs, you will get the same performance. It will not perform any differently. And as long as you're buying from a legit brand. Now, if you go on like one of the Chinese like commerce websites and buy some shady thing for $5, yeah, okay. But if you're buying from Crucial, you're buying from OWC, going to Corsair, any quality name brand RAM supplier, Micron, although Micron, I guess, is Crucial anyway, technically, but you're going to get, as long as it's the same specs, that's the thing, you have to pay attention to the specs. In this case, DDR4, 2666, you will have the same performance. There is no difference. There is no benefit. And it used to be they would argue, well, now your warranty is void. No, there have been court decisions in California specifically. They cannot do that unless they prove you damaged the computer by trying to install it. And you can save some big money. So Apple charges $200. The base configuration ships with 8 gigs. They charge $200 to go to 16. They charge $600 to go to 32. And $1,400 to go to 64 gigs. Crucial, for example, you can get 32 gigs of RAM, which is 2 16-gigabyte SODIMMs, for $300, a little less than $300. So you're looking at half the cost, and you still get to keep the 8 gigs they ship it with. Like, so you could sell that, you could keep it in case you want to do troubleshooting, in case something fails. There is no good reason to stick with Apple RAM, except in the 64-gigabyte configuration, because there's only two slots on the system. So in that case, they're using 32 gigabyte SODIMMs. And those are available. Samsung started producing them earlier this year. But they're really only available for OEMs, for the computer manufacturers. They're very expensive. They're almost impossible to find through normal commercial channels like Newegg and Amazon. And so in that case, if you need 64 gigs today, you pretty much should go with Apple. It's expensive, but if you need that and you know you need it, spend it. Otherwise, in a year, 32 gigabyte SODIMMs, will be more available. The cost will be more reasonable.
Should be readily available.
Less. Yeah, they'll be much less than what Apple's charging today. So if you can, if you think, you know, if you can get by with 32, for example,
and 32 is going to be enough for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's more than enough for the typical user. You can launch virtual machines. You can do all your video editing. Only in the case where you're using this as a server, which is a use case that Apple's heavily pushing on this new model, would you, and not only a server, but certain types of servers, would you want to really go with that 64 gigs? Or also, if you know you're going to be doing, you know, very detailed model rendering and modeling, where you just throw RAM at a scratch disk or throw RAM at a render queue, in that case, yes. But
or like you have like more money than you know what to do with,
which is also a large, you know, not an insignificant demographic of Apple customers.
Okay.
So,
but otherwise, the point is, go to OWDC, go to Crucial, go to a trusted Apple-oriented RAM vendor, and buy their 32-gig kit.
Yeah, spend $300, get the 32-gig, just make sure. Like, now, if you go to OWC, I think they have you pick it out by model, so it's very clear, you know, that you're buying the right memory.
Yes.
And at Crucial, they also have a system picker. It's not as clear because they target a market that includes PCs, so it's not as Apple-focused, but you can still identify it by model. But if you're unsure, just look for the tech specs for your Mac Mini. You can go to Apple. Well, actually, Apple's website is not 100% clear on that. I would go to something like everymac.com, get the detailed tech specs, in this case, DDR4, 2666, and then you can go to any vendor that is reputable and buy that spec of memory, and you'll be fine. There will be no difference.
Yeah, have you taken one of these apart yet?
No, I don't have one yet with this, but I mean, like this, the 2018 model. We've got several Mac Minis going back to the 2010s, but not this particular one.
It should take a matter of days for there to be how-to videos up on YouTube showing you exactly how to replace this stuff yourself.
There already are, because the media outlets that were sampled review copies or review samples showed the take apart process. I'm sure iFixit will have something if they don't already. Yep. It's not impossible. My point with mentioning this wasn't to say that it's some impossible task. It's just, it's not as clear as it may have looked. And if you have experience with those older models, it's not as easy as those other models. You're going to have to get some screwdrivers, and you're going to have to take your time and remove a few things to get to it. But if you're talking about saving $300, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, that's what I recommend.
More RAM.
More RAM is always good, yeah. Especially more RAM for not $600.
Yes, right. And it's funny because Apple years ago was way, way out of you know, in crazy land with the RAM pricing. And then 3 or 4 years ago, it started to get more reasonable.
Yeah, it wasn't reasonable. It wasn't reasonable. Yeah.
Right, it was not close to DIY prices, but it was more reasonable. And now it seems like they've just gone. They're like, okay, yeah, ASP's going up, baby. We're taking this thing to $2 trillion. Get on the train.
Get on the train and make sure you buy a first class ticket for $1,400.
At the very minimum.
At the very minimum.
That gets you on the train.
If that gets you on the train.
That service, we'll talk about that later.
Okay, so listen. You are the one who prepped our topic list.
Yeah,
and I'm starting to feel like, no, I appreciate it. Are you kidding? You know, like, my work is done here. But I'm really starting to feel like you were writing some Mac Geek Gab fanfic.
Hmm. Okay.
This has definitely got a kind of a more of a Mac Geek Gab feel.
Sure.
Than the typical ACM, which is fine. I'm not complaining by any stretch of the imagination, but that does take us to our third topic. And you were going on about RAM before. Now it's something like blah, blah, Ethernet, giganibits, blah, well, blah. See,
you know, on TV shows, they do crossovers, like mm-hmm. the network crossover events. Mm-hmm. This is just like some sort of bizarre, twisted crossover.
Yeah, it's fanfic. It's MGG fanfic.
Sure. Sorry.
Again, You made my job extraordinarily easy today, and I appreciate it.
I'll just wait till you get the hate mail. Then you can tell me what you think. And that'll be hate mail from me to you. I'm prepping my emails now. But yeah. So 10 gigabit networking, obviously. You know, a gigabit is the standard. It's been the standard for several years. That's 1,000. It translates in real world to about 100 megabytes per second if you're at full gigabit speed. And for a while, that was awesome. But your Mac has an SSD in it that can do 3,500 megabytes a second. You've got Thunderbolt 3 storage arrays that are doing maybe not that fast, but you know, well over a gigabyte a second. And so your gigabit connection, and again, notice the distinction, gigabit versus gigabyte. Gigabit translates to about 100, it's 128 megabytes, but with overhead, it comes out to about 100 megabytes per second. Now that's the bottleneck. Your wired internet connection, which at one point was amazing, is now the bottleneck of your storage setup on a modern
Well, but only when you're doing stuff internally to your own network.
Oh, sure. Right. Exactly. This is not about...
This may be a surprise to you, but most people aren't doing big giant files between their devices at home.
But with 4K coming from your iPhone, you've got all this new media, pictures keep getting
certainly,
bigger.
Right. And certainly some people do, and which is good enough reason to talk about it. I just want to point out that for most folks, this isn't an issue.
Right, but it's going to become one, I think, as the nature of what we do. I mean,
sure.
Being able to shoot 4K video on your phone with no problem and then copy to iMovie and then want to back it up to your NAS.
Okay, I'll concede your point readily.
Sure, it's time to start thinking about it, even if it's not for today. And Apple seems to agree, which is interesting because they're not usually... Things like this are, you know, they don't always embrace right away, but we see them now embracing USB-C on the iPad. Mm-hmm. And now they've got two Mac models that have native built-in options, at least, for 10 gigabit networking. So you've got the iMac Pro from last year, which has a combo port that can negotiate at 1, 2.5, 5, and 10 gigabits. And then the same now on the Mac Mini. It's an upgradable option. I think it's $100. And it's the same thing. You get the same Ethernet port, RJ45 Ethernet connection, and as long as you're using an appropriate cable and you're connecting to something that's also capable of that higher speed, you can negotiate at greater than 1 gigabit speeds. But even if you don't have one of those, you can add one to any Thunderbolt Mac. Thunderbolt 1, you know, if you've got an older Thunderbolt 1, you can use some adapters and you might be getting into some limits depending on what you connect it with. But Thunderbolt 2 and Thunderbolt 3, of course, more than enough bandwidth to accommodate your displays, your storage, and your networking. And you can add any one of a number of 10 gigabit network cards and bring your 2 or 3 year old Mac into this new era of faster local networking, at least. And that's what we did here. We've tested a number of options. We tested one from Promise, which Promise is the storage company that makes those Thunderbolt arrays. Mm-hmm. They've got one. We've got one from Sonnet here that is basically just an external PCIe box that connects via Thunderbolt 3, and then it ships with a Intel X550 10 gig NIC in it. So that comes all packaged. But then you can also buy any one of these other empty Thunderbolt 3 enclosures and buy an Intel NIC. You have to be careful because not every NIC is supported, but Intel NICs, a lot of the Aquantia stuff is going to work out of the box, no drivers needed. And you plug it in, you plug your network into that, and you go, and you're off at 10 gig. So it's here. It is here. The prices are not super cheap. You're looking at a couple $100, and then you got to upgrade your switch perhaps. In my case, when I started doing this, I was connecting two computers directly. So I didn't have to worry about buying a switch or anything. You had two computers with 10 gig NICs in them. And once you get to that point, you don't need to worry about local storage as much. You're able to transfer files at a gigabyte per second instead of 100 megabytes a second. So for a lot of things, not just backing up, but you can have your working storage on a high-capacity NAS in the closet, and then you've got your nice iMac or your MacBook or whatever it may be, your Mac Mini, and you don't have to have all that loud, noisy storage array sitting there. So it's an option to consider for anyone who's got large storage needs and who is starting to feel limited by that one port. You know, wireless is getting faster. There are wireless configurations that can achieve real-world speeds at close distances over a gigabit per second. And obviously the flash storage and the Thunderbolt storage is there. So don't let that gigabit NIC, that gigabit Ethernet port, be your limiting factor.
Seems like good advice.
Yeah.
So who has which machines should make someone think about this specifically?
So you'll need, like I said, you'll need a Thunderbolt Mac. If you don't have one of the iMac Pros or the Mac Minis, the new ones with the built-in option, you'll need a Thunderbolt, because other interfaces just aren't going to be fast enough to accommodate it. And you'll need anybody who just doesn't have enough storage internally for their needs, either because of backups or because of video files, photos, anybody who's got storage stored elsewhere that has a Thunderbolt capable Mac can buy an adapter, a box, and take advantage of this. And then you're not limited. You're not limited to that 128 gig SSD or even that 1 terabyte SSD that you have inside the Mac.
This all checks out.
Well, I don't know about that, but you know, it's fun. It's awesome. It's awesome to see those network transfers happen at literally 10 times the speed of what you're used to.
Sure. Sure. All right. Well, that makes sense. You heard it here first.
I don't know about that.
Probably not actually first. So, you know, we do live in sci-fi times in some ways. We might be paying $1,400 for 64 gigs of RAM, but we can do these insanely fast transfers.
Yeah, it's all about not having the distance between your data be the limiting factor. You know, you have 2 terabytes of video files over here in a NAS. Why do you have to be limited? You know, that data should be just as fast getting to you on your Mac to edit or to share as data that's local.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Alec, how we're going to come to a point where we don't even think about this stuff. I mean, like, we already think about it less, mm-hmm. right? There was a time when you had computers and you wanted to transfer stuff and you had to start stringing up like Ethernet through your house or dragging, you know, or like getting 100-foot long cord Ethernet cable so you could, you know, connect your two computers. Like, those days are gone. The vast majority of people don't even think about that. Everything is wireless.
Yeah, wireless is going to address the most mainstream needs and even some higher end needs. And now that they're switching to this new, they're relabeling Wi-Fi instead of 802.11 something, it's Wi-Fi 5, Wi-Fi 6.
Yeah.
And those faster standards for local networking, coupled with the next generation of mobile broadband, and this 5G, this encompassing term for these new technologies, that's going to achieve speeds not as fast as you can get today with things like 10 gigabit in the house, but you're going to be able to have a solid wireless connection in the house that's well over a gigabit per second. You're going to be able to walk around town and have several hundred megabits per second of 5G connected data. And like I said, with the freedom you get with a 10 gig network in your house, what that enables you to do is you can work remotely. We're turning things into thin clients again. Back in the day, you know, in a business, you had thin clients that all connected up to the mainframe.
Yeah, thin clients were going to kill. We're going to kill PCs and Macs.
Right.
Once
and they may still, or at least the things may evolve to become that. And that means you know, your photos are in iCloud, your documents are with Google Docs,
there's still a whole lot of people who care about where their data sits, and they don't want their data sitting in the cloud. Photographs in the cloud. They want to keep local control of their stuff.
Yep, and there are solutions for that. A lot of the NASs, like the Synology and QNAP NASs, have a server you can run on the NAS that turns it into your own personal Dropbox. Mm-hmm. So you know, you get all the functionality there of all the automatic syncing and wire, remote access. But the limiting factor there is, what is that upload speed at your house?
Right.
You know, that becomes the problem. And again, as things like 5G networking become more available, maybe that changes. Maybe that forces the traditional ISPs to up their game. I mean, there are some places still that there are today that have good good internet speeds, but a lot of people, at least in the U.S., don't have a good option. And if they do, it's very expensive. But when we get to that point, you do have that option to run your own, you know, I'll say for better lack of a better word, run your own Dropbox or run your own iCloud. And that's going to be an option as well. But the point is, you can go anywhere. You can walk around with your phone. You can log on to someone else's computer. And because all of this networking is ubiquitous and very fast, you can always have access to your data. It's not like, oh, I forgot to copy that to a flash drive, or I need to email this to myself. No, everything's remotely accessible, whether it's through a company's cloud provider or your own personal setup at home.
Word.
Word?
Word. Word up.
Word. Yeah.
Word to it's your exciting. Mother, as the kids say. I'm positive the kids say this.
I don't even pretend to understand anymore. When Fortnite became a thing, I checked out.
Yeah, fair enough. And, you know, spoiler, kids don't actually say that anymore, what I said. Okay, well, Jim Tanis, editor-in-chief over at Tech Review.
Sorry to ruin the show.
Far from it, my friend. And what is your title over at the PCP magazine?
Yes, PCP Weekly. Well, actually, I don't know if you got a PCP addiction, you're probably not keeping track of time. So PCP whenever. But yeah, so there are actually some changes there. Our former editor in chief just went to Intel, so I'm sort of interim managing editor, I guess you'd call it. Kind of.
This is for PCP-er.
Yes. Yes.
And as well as editor in chief over Tech Review.
That's right.
And sometimes contributor at the Mac Observer.
When they let me.
When I can get you. When I can get you, as a matter of fact. Well, thank you very much, man. I sure appreciate you being the inaugural guest host.
You got to set a low standard, so you can only go up from here.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. I was careful. This is what we in the business call a strategic move.
Absolutely.
Okay, and on that happy note, now, Jim, you're not going to hear it because I don't have everything quite set up right, but we're going to do a little bit of a bumper here, and thanks again.
Sure thing.
Uh-huh. All right. We're going to try that again. It's a good thing I can just edit that out. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com or head over to Facebook at facebook.com/groups/contextmachine.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded for TMO. And that's all for this week.
Stay subscribed.
And we'll see you online at the Mac Observer. Oh, I screwed it up.
That's quite all right. All right, thanks, Jim. See you later.
All right, thanks, Brian.
Well, maybe we're going to go ahead and turn the volume up on this bumper, too. That's how we roll here. Oh, amateur hour, man.
That last line got pushed to the next page. I didn't see it.